Welcome to ForTruth.net, a ministry of the Apologetics and Interfaith Evangelism Department of the North American Mission Board. My name is Rob Bowman. I'm the manager of that department, and I'm joined by phone today by Dan Wallace. Dan Wallace is a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, and he is an expert in the field of New Testament textual criticism, which is the discipline that studies the various manuscripts that exist, that are available of the New Testament, and sorts through them, sifts through them to see, as best we can tell, what the original wording of the New Testament books was. And so it's a very important component of biblical studies. And Dr. Wallace is very knowledgeable in New Testament studies in general. But that is his, perhaps, his area of expertise, his forte. And so I've asked him to spend a little bit of time with us and explain what New Testament textual critics do, answer some common questions that people have about the discipline. I'd also like to let people know that Dr. Wallace has written some books that are very helpful, that would be worth their acquiring and using and reading. Two books I'd like to mention, one especially for those of you who are seminary students, Bible college students, pastors, anybody who's interested in really in studying the Bible in depth. There is a book that Dr. Wallace has done called Greek Grammar Beyond the Basics. And in fact, if you're an evangelical Christian who has studied the New Testament in any depth, you probably already know about this book, because it has fast become a standard reference for the study of New Testament Greek grammar. It's called Greek Grammar Beyond the Basics. Again, the author's name is Daniel B. Wallace. And then the other book I'd like to mention, Dan co-authored with a couple of other gentlemen, and that book is called Reinventing Jesus. Reinventing Jesus. And if you would like a good, solid study in what we're going to be talking about here in the next 45 minutes to an hour about New Testament textual criticism, if you'd like specifics that you can read and digest and spend a good amount of time on, then there's a few chapters in that book that Dr. Wallace authored that explain the whole discipline of New Testament textual criticism, explain why we can rely on the wording of the text in the New Testament as it's come down to us, provides a wealth of statistical information and examples of the discipline in action, and interacts with critics of the Bible who claim that we cannot rely on the wording of the New Testament text as it has come down to us. And so I highly recommend the book Reinventing Jesus for those chapters alone. And then there's other great chapters in the book as well that deal with other subjects of relevance to the study of the New Testament and of the historical Jesus, what Jesus really said and did, who he was. So let me, again, just recommend this book, Reinventing Jesus. And Daniel Wallace is one of three co-authors of that particular book. Dan, I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us here on ForTruth.net.
Well, thanks, Rob. I'm glad to be here, too.
Now, I understand that in addition to your duties and service as a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, that you had an organization that studies New Testament manuscripts and is working to advance the field of New Testament textual criticism. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, it's called the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. And we have a website that has the initials csntm.org or .org. And on that website, there are several thousand pictures of manuscripts that we have photographed in the last 5 years. Our initial objective is to photograph as many Greek New Testament manuscripts as we possibly can get permission to photograph with very high-resolution digital cameras, and to make those available to scholars. There's quite a few manuscripts out there, so it's a huge challenge. And I'm sure we'll talk more a little bit about how many manuscripts are out in the world in a little bit later on the show. But in the meantime, we're trying to get these manuscripts photographed, make them available to scholars so that we can actually analyze the text, which will help us to recover the exact wording of the New Testament much better than we can today.
That's terrific. Again, that's called the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. And the web address is csntm.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Everybody who's interested in the subject, I really encourage you to visit that website. And again, also take a look at Dr. Wallace's contribution to the book Reinventing Jesus, which will give you really more specific information and numerous examples than and still for general readership than what we can do in this short program. Dan, I understand that you travel all over the globe photographing these manuscripts. Now, you've already mentioned that, you know, this is part of this center's work, and but could you explain a little bit more why? I mean, don't we already have books that kind of give us the summary of what's in these Greek manuscripts? How is this going to help us be even more precise in our understanding of the text?
That's a great question, Rob. What we're doing is, as I said, taking high-resolution digital photographs, and the vast majority of our New Testament manuscripts have not been digitally photographed, although about 90% of them have been microfilmed, and the microfilm cameras that were used were about 50 years old. So the quality of the images is rather poor.
Wow.
Digital quality can be as much as 10 or 20 times better than microfilm quality.
So, in fact, there may actually be mistakes in the literature as to what some of these manuscripts say at certain points because people are relying on faded or poor photography of the manuscripts.
Not only mistakes, but in many places we simply can't read those manuscripts because all the microfilm work was done in black and white, and sometimes the letters of these manuscripts are in red, which is going to come out very faint in the photograph, or in gold letters, which is almost impossible to photograph.
Yeah.
The third longest Greek New Testament manuscript, which is housed at the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, it's almost 1,300 pages long, is written only in red and gold letters. And we digitally photographed that. It filled 10 DVDs, about 48 megabytes per photograph. So,
wow. Well, this, I mean, you would think that in this age of the advancing technology that is available, that, you know, this would be something that everybody who's involved in biblical studies would be very excited about. And I'm excited about it. So I'm glad to hear that you're on the cutting edge of doing that. And let's back up, though, here, because we're talking about these manuscripts and, you know, these copies. You know, some people are perhaps not aware of this, but are not sure what the answer to this question. Do we have any of the original manuscripts of the New Testament books?
No, they've all disappeared. Tertullian talks about them in the late 2nd century, where he says that the original still existed, but his opinion has been fairly discredited because he tended to go over the top in terms of what he thought was true. Irenaeus, also in the late 2nd century, another a patristic writer, a church father, said that he had seen early copies of the book of Revelation, but the fact that he did not mention that he'd seen the original suggests that it had already disappeared. But although we don't have the original documents of the New Testament, some Christians would like to say, well, the reason we don't have them is because otherwise people would be venerating those documents or worshiping them. And although that may be true, I'm not so sure you can really use that as an argument because we don't have the original documents of any Greek or Latin literature. We have copies only. And so consequently, if we're going to use the argument, gee, God destroyed that so people wouldn't worship it, I guess that means God destroyed the Iliad and the Odyssey and all sorts of other documents because of that. I don't buy that one.
Well, evangelicals are often charged or accused of bibliolatry. And I have never seen an evangelical bowing down to a Bible or, you know, even treating a Bible as if it was, you know, God, you know, and acting that kind of way. So I'm not sure. I think I would agree with you. I'm not sure that this idea that if we had the originals, people would be worshiping them is valid. They probably would line up to see them. But they line up to see 4th century manuscripts. So
right.
I don't know that that would be, you know, that would be a big difference. So if we don't have the original manuscripts, many people worry that, you know, we really have no idea what the original said. And so, I mean, I think the popular conception is when, for example, when John begins his gospel saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," we really don't have any idea if John ever wrote any such thing. For all we know, he wrote, "I'd like a cheeseburger and fries to go." You know, I think some people have this idea that there may be no relationship whatsoever between the wording of the Bible as we now have it and the wording of whatever the original documents might have said. Could you address that?
Yeah, let me explain a little bit about how the nature of the work of textual criticism goes about. Textual critics are looking at our earliest Greek manuscripts to see what they have to say, and they're comparing those Greek manuscripts with early translations into other languages. Beginning in the 2nd century, the New Testament started to get translated into other languages, such as Latin, and then later into Coptic, which was an ancient language that finally died about 500 years ago, Syriac, Armenian, Georgian, Old Church Slavonic. There's all sorts of languages that you've probably never heard of before, but that the New Testament was translated into. And we can compare the Greek manuscripts, our earliest Greek manuscripts, with these earliest versions, and also compare those to quotations of the New Testament by early church fathers, or these basic scholars and leaders of the early church who commented on the New Testament and quoted from it hundreds of thousands of times. When we make this threefold comparison and we go across geographical boundaries, and we discover that a verse such as John 1:1 is in every manuscript, every version, every patristic writing, except for one 8th century manuscript, is virtually identical in every. Then what we're looking at is we're saying more than likely John wrote exactly what we have in John 1:1.
Now, I'm going to throw you a little curve here, but I don't think you're having trouble with this. Some people today may, and in fact, I've just encountered this yesterday, that some people asking, well, how do we know the New Testament was originally written in Greek? Maybe it was written in Hebrew or Aramaic or some other language. Why do scholars seem to be so convinced, it seems to be virtually unanimous, that the New Testament writings were originally written in Greek?
Well, I think a good argument for that would simply be that the earliest manuscripts we have are Greek. The comments by the patristic writers are comments on the Greek text or the Latin text, but not comments on some Aramaic or Hebrew text. Now, there are some, for example, Papias, who writes in the beginning of the 2nd century that Matthew wrote the sayings of the Lord in Hebrew, but he never says that what Matthew wrote was a gospel in Hebrew, and that has been long debated as to exactly what Papias meant by that. Consequently, that's the one book that some scholars would say, we think Matthew was originally written in a Semitic language. Aramaic is so close to Hebrew that a non-Hebrew or Aramaic speaker would confuse the two. And so I think that's one of the reasons why a very, very small handful of scholars would say Matthew is originally in Aramaic. But when you look at all the evidence, we just don't have any early manuscripts in Semitic languages of the New Testament. They come hundreds of years later. And I would add that there's also a parallel with the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament done a century and a half, 2.5 centuries, 3 centuries before the beginnings of the New Testament. And the Septuagint was done for Jews who lived outside of Israel. And consequently, since most of the books of the New Testament are written to people who are outside of Israel, we would say that they have already followed a pattern where these Jews knew Greek. That was the lingua franca of the day. Even in Israel, Jews knew Greek. And I would say there's plenty of evidence to suggest, for example, that there were pockets of Pharisees in first century Jerusalem who knew Greek, but they did not know Hebrew or Aramaic. And consequently, most people in Israel grew up either bilingually, Greek and Aramaic, or they knew just Greek.
Well, I think all of what you said, you know, is very compelling and explains why it's really hard to find any scholars who think that any book of the New Testament, with the possible partial exception of Matthew, was written in anything originally in anything other than Greek. So that seems to be a settled matter. And as you said, our earliest manuscripts of the New Testament are basically in Greek, and we don't have anything like early manuscripts in Hebrew or Aramaic. So those are all very compelling points. Now, speaking of these manuscripts that we do have in Greek, can you give us some idea how many manuscripts of the New Testament we have in Greek and maybe in other languages as well?
As far as the manuscripts that we have in Greek, the number currently stands at approximately 5,700. I won't get into the details of how much over or under that is, but 5,700 is a good estimate on how many manuscripts we actually know exist of the Greek New Testament. Now, that's a massive number, which I'm sure we'll discuss later on in this program, but when we compare that to the versions, the early versions of the New Testament, it's remarkable that we actually have more copies of the New Testament in Latin than we do in Greek. And part of the reason for that is that the Latin church was much larger than the Greek church, and once the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches split, then Latin was the language of Western Europe, and the Greek Orthodox church kind of shrunk into Turkey and Greece, essentially, and did not have much of an influence outside of that. We have approximately 10,000 copies of the New Testament in Latin, which is an astounding number. And then you look at some of the other ancient versions, such as Syriac and Coptic, and no one has really done a full count of these, but those two are the next most plentiful. And when we get beyond the Syriac and the Coptic and look at Georgian, Armenian, and some of these other languages, the numbers, we're not exactly sure, but our best guess is that among the versions, we have about 20,000 copies, maybe as many as 25,000 copies. So when you count that with the Greek New Testament, we've got between 25 and 30,000 copies of the New Testament in various languages on handwritten manuscripts.
Now, just to clarify and make sure that this these figures are not being misunderstood and perhaps misunderstood in a way that might come across in an inflated way, we're not talking about 5,700 complete copies of every book of the New Testament in Greek, are we?
No, we're not, and that's a good point. The later we go, the more complete they get. However, there's a couple of caveats to note. First of all, most of the manuscripts we have of the New Testament are actually complete as far as was intended by that scribe. That does not mean that the scribe intended to write out the entire New Testament. We only have 60 copies of the entire Greek New Testament in Greek manuscripts. So of that 5,700, about 1% of them are actually complete New Testaments from Matthew to Revelation. However, most of our manuscripts, over half of them, are Gospels manuscripts, and the vast majority of those are complete Gospels manuscripts. So the Gospels, which comprise almost a half of our New Testament, here we're dealing with manuscripts that have those four books, and the majority of those manuscripts have the complete Gospels. Then we have manuscripts that have just Paul's letters. That's the second largest group of manuscripts. So to give some numbers along these lines, among the manuscripts that have the Gospels, we have about 3,000 or so.
Wow.
Among those that have Paul's letters, we have about 800, so it's a significantly smaller amount. Now, there are some manuscripts that have the Gospels and Paul's letters, of course, at least those 60 that have the whole New Testament do, and then there's several others that have it as well. Then among the what's called the Catholic letters in Acts, Catholic letters are also known as the general letters, the ones not written by Paul, basically James through Jude. Those manuscripts, there's about 700 of those. What comes in dead last is the book of Revelation. We have approximately 350 copies of Revelation. And so when you look at all these together, you say, well, the Gospels, there's almost 10 times as many manuscripts of the Gospels as there are of Revelation. The early church was very, very concerned to get the Gospels reproduced. They were not nearly as concerned about Revelation because it took some time to get accepted in both the Eastern and Western churches into the canon.
Could it be also, at least in part, that the early church, like Bible societies today, just made a lot more copies of the Gospels because they used them a lot more? I mean, we Bible societies today rarely print a pamphlet or a booklet that just contains the book of Revelation, but they will often do just the Gospel of John, because that is a book that they want to give to new Christians or to people who are finding out about Christianity for the first time. Is it possible that that is at least perhaps a partial explanation for why there are so many more copies of the Gospels?
I imagine that could be a part of it, although you have to keep in mind that these manuscripts, were not cheap to produce, and most of the manuscripts we have were done most likely in a scriptorium. They were done either for wealthy patrons, churches, or to keep at that monastery, that scriptorium. So to have these be used as an evangelistic tool, I think in the age of handwriting, we probably didn't have nearly as much of that.
That's a good point. Now, you know, when you say the one that comes in dead last is the Book of Revelation, and we've only got, and I say only with sort of imaginary quotation marks here, 350 copies of the complete Book of Revelation, or virtually complete. Even with even that number, if I understand it, our copies, available copies of the New Testament books, are extremely numerous and plentiful in comparison with other ancient literature. Is that correct?
It really is. Yes, we're embarrassed by the riches that we have in terms of the New Testament manuscripts. If you compare this to, for example, some major historians who lived at about the time that the New Testament was being written, it's embarrassing how many copies we have. You take, for example, the three major Roman historians, all 1st century B.C. to 2nd century A.D., Livy, Tacitus, and Suetonius. And the earliest manuscripts we have of Livy, these are the three guys on which we are basing our understanding of the history of ancient Rome. I mean, they're that important. But Livy, we have 27 copies of his manuscripts, and of those 27, they're really of a partial amount of books that he actually wrote. We don't even have all of his books. We only have about a fourth or maybe a third of the books that Livy actually wrote. The earliest copies come from the 4th century, so we're talking about something that's about 400 or 500 years after the time he wrote. Tacitus, we have three copies of his works, and the earliest copies come from the 9th century, so about 800 years after him. And you're basing our understanding of the Roman history in the ancient world on these two authors, along with Suetonius. Now, Suetonius, we have a lot of copies of. We have over 200, but the earliest ones come from the 9th century also. So when you start making those comparisons with the New Testament, and you think, gee whiz, even with Revelation, we've got copies that come from the 3rd century, not complete copies, they're fragmentary. We have a complete copy from the 4th century, and we're looking at that kind of a thing. What we're saying is what we have, even for the Book of Revelation, is extremely plentiful in comparison with these other ancient historians, more plentiful than the others.
Now, if we can make another comparison, instead of comparing with the Roman historians' writings, today there's a lot of people who are very enamored of the Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, for example. And what's the manuscript evidence like for something like the Gospel of Thomas in comparison with, you know, the four Gospels or any other book of the New Testament?
It's pretty bad, really. Gospel of Thomas, we have one book in Coptic that was discovered when the Nag Hammadi finds were discovered in 1945, and we have three earlier fragments in Greek that were known long before Nag Hammadi. We just didn't know what they were from. And then when the Nag Hammadi manuscripts were discovered, these Greek manuscripts are also from the Gospel of Thomas. And what's remarkable is they represent about 20% of the Gospel of Thomas, the Greek fragments do. But there's several significant differences between the Greek manuscripts and the Coptic manuscript. And what that tells us is that here's a document that was probably not considered to be sacred. When it was copied, it was modified significantly to fit in more into Gnostic ideology. I don't think the Gospel of Thomas was originally a Gnostic document, but later it was used by the Gnostics, and they had to modify it significantly to make it kind of fit into that viewpoint a little bit more.
So the Gospel of Thomas was originally written in Greek. We have three partial fragments of it in Greek, and then we've got this Coptic translation from several centuries later, and only one copy of that, and that's it. Is that about right?
Except that I'd say that the Coptic manuscript is not several centuries, but it's probably just a couple centuries later.
Okay. Is this pretty typical for the Gnostic writings?
No, I think it's pretty decent for the Gnostic writings to have that many copies.
It's one of our better attested Gnostic writings.
Now, we knew about the Gospel of Thomas from the patristic writers. They talked about it extensively, and they quoted it and misquoted it. But then when we found this gospel, then that was a very important discovery for us to really think through what the Gospel of Thomas said and why it was not particularly well received in the church. The Gospel of Judas was virtually unheard of until this discovery was made, and we have one copy of that, as you know. And then you've got these others, the Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Mary. There's all sorts of Gnostic Gospels where we typically have one copy. Now, some might want to argue that the reason we only have one copy of that is because the Orthodox Christians did such a great job in destroying these manuscripts. The problem with that argument is we have very few copies of the early apostolic fathers who were considered to be Orthodox. For example, the Didache is considered an apostolic patristic writing. That is a second century, early second century, maybe even a first century Christian document. And there's one complete copy of that in existence, and that's in Jerusalem. It's 11th century. So you start making those comparisons. You say, well, gee, what do we base our views or our text of Ignatius on? We've got just a handful of manuscripts of Ignatius, another patristic writer. Most of these Orthodox writers have very few copies as well. To be sure, they have a little bit more, typically, than the Gnostic writings, but not anything compared to the New Testament. The New Testament just blows away all of the competition in terms of the number of copies and the proximity of the dates of those copies to the original.
Now, even though we've got a lot of copies of the New Testament in Greek, and again, as you said, 10,000 copies or manuscripts of parts of the New Testament in Latin, aren't there a lot of differences among these manuscripts? Aren't there a lot of variations? And don't these, you know, constitute a problem for the reliability of the New Testament text?
There are differences. In fact, when you start thinking through those manuscripts, when you count the Greek manuscripts, the versions, and the patristic writings, and what I didn't mention earlier is that when we look at how many quotations we have of the New Testament by the Church Fathers, starting in the late first century all the way through the 13th, to date we have counted more than 1 million quotations of the New Testament by these patristic writers. That's just absolutely astounding.
Wow.
and so when you think about the massive numbers of manuscripts we have, that massive number of manuscripts is going to produce a massive number of textual variants. It would be virtually impossible to have all these manuscripts say exactly the same thing every time. And for some scholars to say if God intended to preserve the text, he would have done it perfectly, that's going to set up such an unrealistic view of the world that some you look at it and say, okay, well, here's the scribe who's copying out the New Testament, and he falls asleep and doesn't get it done. Maybe he has a heart attack, you know, whatever. You say, well, we're going to destroy that manuscript because it's not perfect. So, if a scribe makes a mistake, what do you do? Is God going to kill him? And that's the kind of a nonsense view that some scholars want to demand of the New Testament. And I think they're really getting that more from the Muslim doctrine of how the Quran was done, when it really wasn't done like that, but they make that kind of a claim.
And I think that it would be impossible to please some of these critics no matter what. For example, if we had, you know, hundreds of manuscripts of the New Testament that read exactly the same way, word for word, letter for letter, I can just hear it now. Well, obviously, the church conspired to make sure that only the manuscripts that said exactly what they wanted to say were preserved and the rest were destroyed. So now there's, you know, we would have another kind of objection if the manuscripts were too similar. So I actually think it's kind of a good thing that the variances in the manuscripts suggest to me that there was no autocratic organizational control over the copying of the manuscripts. There was nobody standing over a scribe's head with a sword saying, make sure it says this or I'll kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, the people just made copies, more or less freely without religious muckety-mucks telling them what it had to say, which was, of course, the way it really happened with the Quran. People were forced at sword point to give up copies of the Quran that didn't mention the right successor to Muhammad. So I'm actually glad that there's all these variations because it tells me that I'm not trusting some organization that claims that it preserved the Bible correctly.
I think that's an excellent point. You have the New Testament copies not only disseminating very, very early on throughout the entire Mediterranean region, but they're also disseminated in the form of a codex, which is our modern book. And in other words, so where it's bound on the left side and you turn the pages rather than a scroll or a roll, as all other books were done up until the end of the first century. And with that modern book form that was invented by the end of the first century, Christians adapted it much, much earlier than the rest of the world did. In the first 500 years A.D., 80% of all Christian books are written on a codex, and only 20% of non-Christian books are written on a codex. That's a remarkable difference that suggests that there's something about the codex that attracted the Christians. And one of the things that I think did this is that they're searching for their doctrines to find out what the text says. They want to get copies of these manuscripts in the hands of people, and they began to recognize that the Gospels carried a certain authoritative weight, and the codex could hold more material than a roll could or a scroll could. A scroll could hold, for example, the Gospel of Luke, but it could not hold Luke and Acts, and certainly not all four Gospels, while as a codex could hold the entire New Testament. And early on, we start getting codices that were having more than just a single book, several books. Even by the age of AD 200, we have most of Paul's letters in one. We have one that had the Gospels and Acts in another. So this form is something that the Christians are disseminating so they can read these texts, they can copy it out, they can disseminate the information. And yet, we have a lot of these done by private individuals, not in a scriptorium, because they simply want to get the information out. So Christianity grew by its own organic life rather than through some kind of a structural limitation on it.
I think that's very helpful for people to understand. Now let me ask you, Dan, the mistakes that are in the manuscripts, what kinds of mistakes do they tend to be? Did they tend to leave stuff out that the scribe didn't like? Did they tend to add a lot of stuff? They just didn't spell things. I mean, what kinds of mistakes tend to be the most numerous in these manuscripts?
In answer to your question, it's yes, they did all those things. we don't have exact percentages because there are literally hundreds of thousands of textual variants or changes among the manuscripts. And when the first time somebody hears that, they can really panic and think, my gosh, there's hundreds of thousands of changes. Well, how could we possibly tell what the original text said? Well, the way that we do that is most of these textual differences, or textual variants is what they're called, are inconsequential. They are spelling differences or nonsense errors that a scribe made because he wasn't paying as close attention as he could have. For example, the most common variant that we see in the manuscripts is what's called a movable new. It's the letter N at the end of a word when the next word starts with a vowel. It's exactly the same kind of a principle that we have in English when we say an apple or a book. You drop the N if you have the next word start with a consonant, and you keep it if it starts with a vowel. And the Greek manuscripts do this. That's the most common particular variant we have among the New Testament manuscripts. Then you've got spelling differences for the name of John. Virtually every time you see the name John, it's either spelled with two N's in the middle or one N. You've got different spellings on other words where there's a thing that involves vowels that have no impact on the meaning whatsoever. It's just spelling differences. And I believe that somewhere in the range of 75 to 80% of all of our textual variants are of this sort, spelling changes that don't affect anything. Then the next largest category is going to be those that make no translational difference or they involve synonyms. And the reason they would not make a translational difference is because of transpositions or word order changes. Greek is a highly inflected language, which means that it can put the object first and the subject last, and it still means the same thing because of the endings on the words that can identify this is the object, this is the subject. If anybody's taken Spanish or German or some other foreign language that's fairly well inflected, they understand this. So if you say in Greek, Jesus loves John, you can say it with John first in the sentence, loves second, and Jesus last. And you'd still read it, Jesus loves John, because Jesus is in the nominative case and John is in the accusative case. So you can tell by the endings what the subject is and what the object is. Well, there's actually, you take a three-word sentence like that, and there are 16 different ways to arrange that without changing the meaning one iota. So that's the kind of that's the second largest category, is these transpositions or synonyms, where they may use Lord or Jesus interchangeably, it's the same person. That's a very large category. The third largest category of textual variants has to do with those that are meaningful variants. That is, they do impact the meaning of the text, our understanding of the text to some degree, but they are not viable. And by viable, I mean that they don't have any kind of a pedigree that suggests that it goes back to the original text. So if you find a variant in a 12th century manuscript and it sticks out there by itself, you say, how in the world did this guy get this wording from someplace? Like in 1 Thessalonians 2:9, there's a 12th century manuscript that says, "We preach to you the gospel of Christ," I think is what it is. While as in most manuscripts, it's the gospel of God. And this one 12th century manuscript has the gospel of Christ. Well, that's a meaningful variant. It's a different reading. It helps us to understand the text differently, but it doesn't have any pedigree. You know, for the first 11 centuries, you say, how come we don't see any other manuscripts with this? And consequently, that's called a meaningful variant, but not a viable one. And then the fourth category is what everybody is really concerned about, and that's the variants that are both meaningful and viable. And yet, by far, we have no more than 1% of all of our variants fitting into that category. In fact, that's really a high estimate. So we have less than 1% of all the textual variants that are both meaningful and viable.
Now, if that's the case, can you give us some kind of a general estimate as to how much of the New Testament is really beyond doubt or beyond reasonable doubt as to the original wording?
I think that's a good way to put it, beyond reasonable doubt. We're dealing with at least 99% of the text is beyond reasonable doubt as to what the original wording was.
So my suggestion that John 1:1 started off with an order for a cheeseburger is just not realistic. It's not in the realm of possibility.
I would say that's not in the realm of possibility. And I don't like to speak in terms of absolutes too often when I'm doing historical research, but I mean, obviously cheeseburgers weren't invented back then. But nevertheless, I'd say to see that John wrote something other than what we have
right
in our manuscripts is just not in the realm of possibility.
Well, I think this is very important, and I used a ludicrous example because, I mean, people are saying ludicrous things that that are almost just as crazy as what I said, suggesting that the New Testament writers originally taught reincarnation, and that somehow there was a suppression of that from the manuscripts of the New Testament. Well, that's really just about as crazy, maybe crazier than my silly example about the cheeseburger, because there is absolutely no manuscript evidence for this claim that the church suppressed reincarnation from the Bible.
Exactly, and I'd like to mention a statement that Kurt Aland said. He was the head of the Institute for Neutestamentliche Textforschung, or the Institute for New Testament Textual Research in Münster, Germany. He died about a dozen years ago, and it was considered to be a world-class, perhaps the very best textual critic in the world. And one of the things he said is that any reading that ever gets into the manuscripts at any stage from the original to later manuscripts is always going to be preserved in some manuscript down the line. And so he felt that all of the variations that we have among the manuscripts is going to be seen in some of these manuscripts, including the original wording. What that means is, in Aland's mind, there's no reason ever for us to come up with a conjecture, that is, come up with something out of thin air as to what the original text in this particular verse should be. We should be always able to find the original wording in some manuscript. And when you reduce it to that, by the way, most New Testament scholars would agree with him that there's no reason for conjecture any place. When you reduce it to that, what that means is that we can test to see whether the New Testament has been corrupted by looking at all the variants.
So in other words, if I could use an analogy, it would be like saying we may have a box of puzzle pieces that may have some extra puzzle pieces in it that don't belong in the picture, but in fact we have all the pieces that do belong.
That's great. I'm going to use that. I like that very much.
Yeah, well, I think people need to understand that. It's not a matter of we lost anything. It's just that we've gained variant readings that are not part of the original text, and through a process of study and analysis, we can, in most cases, determine which ones don't belong. But we've got all the pieces of the text there in the box.
Right. Another analogy to use is that what we really have is about 110% of the Word of God. And our goal is to try to burn off the dross to get to the gold. So it's not a matter of us having only 90%. No, we've got the whole thing. We just don't know if it's in the text or the footnotes in about 1% of the places.
That is very helpful, and I'm sure a lot of people are, this is news to them. They may have been told that in the process of copying, all kinds of stuff got lost, and in fact, that isn't the case.
Right.
I want to ask you about a popular conception that's been around for several years now, and that is that the New Testament didn't originally teach the deity of Christ, that somehow in the process of copying, scribes changed the New Testament to make it conform to a later doctrine of the incarnation of Jesus Christ as God in the flesh. And one scholar in particular, his name has been associated with this claim, and that's Bart Ehrman. Could you address what Professor Ehrman actually showed or argued? Did he actually support that claim? And if so, or even if not, is there anything to this claim that the New Testament didn't originally teach the deity of Christ, but later manuscripts introduced that idea?
It's a great question again. Dr. Ehrman, who teaches at North Carolina Chapel Hill, and he's a research professor there, he's the chairman of the Religious Studies Department, has not in writing made the claim, as far as I can tell, where he says that the deity of Christ is not taught in the original documents. But he has said this on radio when he was on National Public Radio with Diane Rehm a couple years ago. She asked him about these variants and what it may imply, and his answer was, well, we may not be sure that the original New Testament actually spoke of the deity of Christ. And his basis for this was, then he went back to a scholar who lived in the 1700s, a fellow by the name of Wettstein, and he said, well, Wettstein researched these variants, and he said, I don't think the New Testament teaches the deity of Christ. So he didn't produce any evidence from the manuscripts that suggest that, but he appealed to Wettstein, and I thought, I wonder if that's where he's actually going. It's kind of hard to read Ehrman all the time, so I want to give him the benefit of the doubt on this. But I would say, nevertheless, people have understood him to mean that, because he leaves these things open. If you look at the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, by the three authors who preceded Dan Brown and his Da Vinci Code, and basically he got the story from them. What they said was that the deity of Christ was invented by Constantine, essentially. They also argued that we have no New Testament manuscripts before the time of Constantine. Well, those kinds of comments are terribly irresponsible, and they just show that these guys are just making stuff up off the cuff. We have at least 48 manuscripts, Greek manuscripts, that are before the time of Constantine. That's a lot more than none, I think.
Indeed.
We also have manuscripts that predate Constantine that deal with the deity of Christ. For example, at John 1:1, which you quoted already on the show, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We have that in Papyrus 66, which is dated sometimes as early as AD 150, and usually it's dated about 175, maybe as late as 200. But Constantine is in the early part of the 4th century, about 325, and consequently P66 predates him by almost 200 years, at least 150 years before him. And if you're looking at that, you say, well, if that's the case, then P66, which already affirms the deity of Christ, obviously Constantine isn't that old. He couldn't have invented the doctrine.
Right.
P75, another manuscript, it's late 2nd or early 3rd century, has the same exact verse, same exact wording. P46, a manuscript dated around AD 200, has Paul's letters in it, and it has Romans 9:5. It has Hebrews 1:8, and I believe you've got these verses that affirm the deity of Christ, and it's already found in these manuscripts. In fact, if you trace through the history of the major passages that explicitly call Jesus God, I'm not just dealing with all the passages, because this book that you and Ed Komaszewski wrote, Putting Jesus in His Place, is dealing with all the passages where the deity of Christ is something that it doesn't matter what you do with the New Testament text, there's no way for you to get around it. And I want to just, on the show, thank you for that superb book for the
two
guys.
Oh, I appreciate that. thank you.
It's remarkable, and I'm glad for you guys to have done all the work on this thing, and hope you get it out to millions of people. nevertheless, I know you can pay me later for that comment, but
thank you.
I would say that when we start looking at just these passages that explicitly call Jesus Theos, or God,
right,
that they don't change. There's one or two of these verses that do, that we'd say, well, we're not sure if it actually said Theos in the original or not, I mean the word God, but that would, all that would do is change one or two verses. It doesn't change the fact that most of these verses have exactly that. John 1:1, John 20:28, Titus 2:13, Hebrews 1:8, Romans 9:5. You know, these passages are absolutely secure, and you just don't have changes that impact the deity of Christ among the manuscripts.
Let me ask you one more question as our time is rapidly coming to a close here, and that is, I want you to, I'm going to push you a little bit on this, and I'm going to ask you for sort of the worst case situation that we have of the most major, radically glaring textual problem or difficulty, the biggest passage in the New Testament that's in question in any of the copies. Can you give us kind of the worst case that we have, so people get a sense of everything else being, you know, really minor compared to that?
Yes, there are two passages that are quite long. They both involve 12 verses. Now, what's interesting is, and these are worst case in terms of, I think, the emotional baggage that people bring to the table, not in terms of any doctrine that is lost, because I would say that no cardinal belief of Christians today is affected by the viable variants at all. But we have two passages that have been found in our Bibles for centuries, since the time of the printing press, because of, I think, almost a timidity of, or a tradition of timidity that suggests that the translators, although they may have recognized that these passages are not authentic, still put them in because they were concerned that the masses would be disturbed if they weren't. These two passages are Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20, and John 7, 53 through 8, 11. Both of them are 12 verses long, and here's the interesting thing. The long ending of Mark's gospel, which is what it's called, Mark 16, 9 through 20, speaks about the followers of Jesus picking up snakes, drinking poison, not getting hurt, this kind of thing. And that particular passage is found in some pretty old manuscripts. It's mentioned in the second century by patristic writers, so we know that it existed in the second century. It's a very old passage. But is it original? I don't think so, because our oldest manuscripts don't have it, our oldest versions don't have it. We have patristic writers that go back and say the vast majority of manuscripts that they've seen didn't have it, and the better ones didn't have it. So you've got those kinds of comments, then you compare it internally, and scholars would say, this doesn't sound like Mark, it doesn't seem to harmonize with what he's saying in his gospel. So most scholars would say that passage is not authentic. Now, in terms of what's at stake there, I'd say nothing is at stake. You still have a resurrection of Jesus in Mark's gospel if you ended at verse 8, just like you do in the other three gospels. You still have a Lord who performs miracles. What you're losing here is some color commentary on what happened in the book of Acts, which is, I think, why this passage actually arose. Some early Christians saw the miracles the apostles did in the book of Acts and then kind of added that to Mark's gospel. But the other passage, it has got a lot more emotional baggage to it. It's the story of the woman caught in adultery. And that's a passage that I think most Christians would like to have in their Bible. And in fact, it's my favorite passage that's not in the Bible. It's a passage that I think is very interesting. You've got Jesus forgiving this woman who had been caught in the act of adultery, and then you've got these Pharisees that are ready to stone her, and he says the first one who doesn't have sin can cast the first stone, and they peel out from the oldest to the youngest. Very interesting passage, but the problem with it is two things. First of all, we've got some pretty significant evidence that suggests that that story was a conflated story between two different narratives that existed in the East and the West, and probably by the 3rd century or so, they joined hands, maybe a little bit later than that, so that now we have this new story about this woman caught in adultery when it was two different stories that were separate, and it may well be that one of those stories was authentic historically, but whether that means that John actually wrote it is a different matter entirely. And this passage has shown up in several different places in John and in the Gospels. It even shows up at the end of Luke chapter 21 in a group of manuscripts. It shows up at the end of all the Gospels in several other manuscripts. It's a floating text. That's almost always a sure sign that this passage is not authentic because scribes are trying to find a place to fit it in, and it's a passage looking for a home because they like it so much, but it's not an authentic passage.
But again, as you point out, this passage, though it's a nice story, and it seems like it could be something that actually happened. Whether it's part of the Gospel of John or not doesn't really affect any doctrine. It doesn't change our understanding of the message of the Gospel of John. As you said, it's a very nice story that we would like to have in there. But whether it is or not doesn't really materially affect what Christianity teaches.
That's exactly right. And again, I'd say most Christians, if you ask them, which of these two passages would you prefer to have in your Bible if you could only have one? And I've done this experiment many times in churches. It's almost always universal. I'd rather have the story of the woman caught in adultery than the long ending of Mark. And here's the irony. The evidence for the long ending of Mark is significantly stronger than it is for the story of the woman caught in adultery. And yet neither one of these passages is authentic. So if we were to accept one of the two on the basis of evidence, Mark's long ending would have far better credentials than the story of the woman caught in adultery. So Christians often are reading something or wanting something to be true due to emotional baggage, when what we need to do is just to pursue the truth at all costs.
Well, this is why the science of textual criticism is such a valuable discipline, because it puts checks on our emotional investment in passages. It puts checks on our theological biases, where we'd like the Bible to say this or that, and it drives us back to searching out what God really said in Scripture. And so, Dan, I really want to thank you for having given so much of your life to this particular study and helping Christians to understand it and to do it better. And I really want to thank you for your ministry in this area.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's been a pleasure being on the show and talking about some of these things that Christians can have far greater certainty that what they have really does go back to the original, even if we don't know in every place what the original text says.
And give us the web address one more time of the center that you operate that studies these things.
It's CSNTM, and that stands for the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts .org.
All right, and again, folks, if you would like to get more information on this subject, you should check out Dan Wallace's book, Reinventing Jesus, which he co-authored with a couple of other Christian scholars. And also, you can find some articles by Dr. Wallace on our website, which is 4truth.net. And you've been listening to 4truth.net. Thank you very much.